Hi everyone, my name is Mel Hogan, and I'm a critical media studies scholar based in Canada. I'm working on a project called The Data Fix through a series of conversations with scholars, thinkers, and feelers. And together we explore the significance of living in a world of data, and especially the growing trend of digital humans in the form of chatbots, holograms, deepfakes, AI images and videos, and even tech that revives the dead. The conversations are minimally edited and serve as an archive of the collective thinking and feeling that is going into the DataFix project. Please see thedatafix.net for more details and show notes. Thank you so much for listening.
My name is Gabriele De Seta, and I'm from Italy, and I'm currently working as a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Bergen, Norway. Where my PI she's Jill Walker Redberg, professor in digital culture. She has this project about machine vision. So we're studying, it's called Machine Vision in Everyday Life. So we are, we're looking at how different forms of machine vision influence cultural production and society at large from a human science, humanities and social science point of view. And as part of this project, I am studying the Chinese or Chinese-speaking context. So I specialize on looking at Chinese machine vision companies and the use of different technologies in China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and similar places. And this is because my background is it's a bit mixed, but I come from linguistics and area studies, and then by way of cultural studies, and I have a PhD in sociology. So I have studied technology for a long time, and given my language background, I always studied China and Chinese-speaking regions. So that's why I ended up in this project that fits perfectly what I'm doing. So.
Yeah, that's great. I think you sort of answered my second question too, just what drew you as a researcher to the Chinese context. So I think that you've answered that in some ways. We'll get into that because one of the things I want to reference is your article in Convergence, and I will link that in the show notes. But basically, it's a sort of contextualization of deepfakes in a Chinese context. And sometimes, you know, before we dive into this, maybe, you know, you already mentioned machine learning or machine vision, excuse me. And so do you want to start, you know, maybe just, I'm imagining the listeners being quite varied and, you know, different sort of levels of savviness in terms of the technology and the term. So would you mind just defining this, you know, this project, which is located in machine vision? What is machine vision?
Yes. The project is about machine vision as a, at least I think of it as a subset of artificial intelligence. So AI is such a broad field, really hard to define, as you know. And of course, machine vision is sort of the application of machine learning and other forms of automation to visual technologies, optical technologies and visual media. So when you think of surveillance cameras that recognize cars or faces of people, but also drones, right, that have some sort of infrared sensing, or automated cars that drive themselves by looking at the street. And of course, the layer of production of images that draws on this, so deepfakes and face filters. So anything that uses, you know, that passes through a visual sensor of some sort and has some automation in the back, that kind of falls into our definition of machine vision. And it kind of overlaps with the technical definition in computer science and AI, where they are sort of interchangeable. They say either computer vision or machine vision. Computer vision is perhaps a bit more restricted to computers, and machine vision is a bit broader. It includes industrial applications. But yeah, we use it as this sort of theoretical framework to talk about a subset of AI that allows us to go a little bit more in depth in certain types of issues. And also we link it back to a longer history of machine vision before automation, you know, the optical technologies and you know, from the beginning of time, people have used lenses or, you know, to do things or mirrors. And there's a much longer history that we can look at. So that is, what we mean by it.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I guess I have two questions just building off of that. One is you sort of interchange sensing with vision. Yeah. And I find that really interesting because it's really the vision is through sensors, which is a kind of sensing that has nothing to do with, you know, human eyesight. And there's a way in which we sort of apply human sort of capacities to machines. We all do this. It's just sort of a shorthand. Sort of a little bit of, you know, how we got to that kind of sensing or vision with machines. And you mentioned mirrors and other technologies. Do you have a sense a little bit of how we got here? Like just to give us a little bit of that historical, you know, without necessarily, you know, going into too much detail, but just like, how did we get there? What were we building off of? What were we trying to achieve to get into this idea of a machine sort of sensing and seeing?
Yes. Yeah. In my case specifically, I know that, Jill Walker-Redberg has just finished writing her book that has a sort of has this whole history from the beginning of machine vision to up to today. In my case, I've looked at the Chinese side of things, so I can maybe give you an idea from there. But what I found is that optical technologies have been developed in various parts of the world at around the same time, and they have this kind of flows between regions and. For example, in China, very early on, water mirrors were invented that were used, of course, to, you know, reflect yourself, but also put different angles to sort of surveil what was happening outside the wall of your house. So it was sort of the earliest surveillance camera that was just a couple of mirrors reflecting into one another. And then from this, you have the invention of, polished metal mirrors that are more portable. And lenses that are also were also an innovation in Europe, quite important for both technology and philosophy. And in China, these were, you know, applied to similar things, especially with missionaries coming from Europe and bringing over some telescopes with Chinese scientists started looking at stars, but also started using them in their everyday life because, you know, a telescope is this sort of a new media that allows you to see things that humans could not see before, like things that are much farther away, and they kind of collapse some social distance and allow you new forms of power. And then after telescopes, there was, you know, the earlier cameras, like the camera obscura were invented quite early on in China. And then obviously with the global circulation of technology, photography was developed there as well. And I think this is sort of the same path that pretty much, Europe also went through with the development of optical technologies. And up to here, so up to cameras, up to 50 years ago, all of this was analog. So it's quite a consistent history of, maybe zooming into or looking at something very far or looking at something or reproducing a scene with photography. And it was just about manipulating light with materials and making it, you know, imprint on a sheet of metal or paper. I think the one important shift was quite recent, obviously, was the one to the digital. And this shift also changes what you had mentioned in the first part of the question, which is the idea of sensing and sensors, because of course, with optical technologies like a camera or a telescope, they work a little bit like the eye, but you're still looking at things with your own human eye. That is the sensor that then takes in the image. But with digital imaging, the lenses, the principles are all the same, but what's in the back is not a sheet of paper. It's a digital image sensor, which is modeled on the human eye conceptually, but works very differently. And produces different kinds of images. And the key thing about this sort of what we call a visual sensor or image sensor is that it produces an image that looks like a photograph to us, but it's also interpretable as data by by computers, by machines. So it's a sort of a dual use, which allows new forms of manipulation that then include training a machine learning model or photoshopping an image or, you know, cutting and pasting or applying filters. So why I use this term, like visual sensing, visual sensors, is because I think it's important to remember that this is not vision as in human or animal vision. So when you say it's similar to artificial intelligence, not, you know, kind of leads you to think about intelligence. When you say machine vision, you could also think, oh, the machine sees. But actually the machine senses and then outputs an image for the human to see, and also data for the human or other machines to work on or elaborate or do other things. So yeah, I don't know if this answered your question.
No, this is absolutely perfect. And it's a good segue into this idea of manipulation. And so we can get into your piece a little bit, because one of the, you know, so that has this long legacy, and then suddenly there's a kind of a tipping point that leads to a kind of, you know, machine vision, then that affects our own sensing and ability to see things for what they are, you know. And in your piece, you talk about how a deep fake in China is actually, you know, means basically the one that you look at is a changing face. And so I'm fascinated by this idea of manipulation. And then, you know, it is, it alters the way we're able to sense and perceive things and make sense of the real from the not real. And I guess this is the segue into this idea of deep fakes. Can you take just a moment to define deepfakes, and especially in this Chinese context, how you've looked at it? And then we'll go in and through some of the points in the article.
Yes. Yeah, I think what's really interesting when I did that research was also learning about deepfakes, because we tend to assume that, you know, these terms, we tend to assume what they mean. And then when you go look at how they were developed and where they emerged, you realize that they're actually, you know, quite vernacular terms for things. So deepfake was actually the name of a Reddit user and a subreddit that I think they created to upload the first examples of things that then we called deepfakes. And I think the first examples were basically porn, celebrity porn. I don't remember which celebrity, but it was definitely a woman, and some, you know, her face was basically put onto the body of a porn star or something like that. And the name deepfakes was given by this user, I think, taking the deep from deep learning and fakes, obviously, from fakery. So the method that they were applying was a quite revolutionary application of a deep learning model to basically do what face recognition systems do, but reversing it, so that you don't not only identify a face in an image, but you also learn the features of the face. You kind of train a model on two faces, and then you swap them on the two original bodies. So it is quite a vernacular origin. I don't think of deepfake as a scientific term, right? It's what a user made up to describe a new process, a new tinkering with machine learning. And I found it interesting that in China, deepfakes have a different name, right? The title of my paper is Huan Lian. So Huan Lian means, it literally means to change face or swapping faces, or yeah, just the idea of a changing face. And I think this happens quite often in China, that that technological innovations or buzzwords or new hyped terms in tech become translated by a meaning, you know, combining a couple of characters that give a sense of what they are. So it's not a direct translation of deep fake. It's sort of a different term. But what I found interesting is that it's kind of more encompassed, because it encompasses different kind of manipulation. It's not just for the purpose of deceiving, and it's not just for, you know, swapping faces between people. It includes, you know, morphing and changes from cartoon characters, anime characters, or video game characters, or a lot of kinds of basically what is called media manipulation or synthetic media. And also, I think it's important to look at the linguistics of technology, because to me, it evidenced how when we say deepfake, we make a lot of assumptions about, yeah, deep learning and the depth of it and what's fake about it. And it kind of emphasizes the two parts of the word. So a lot of discussion around deepfakes is about fakes and about what is truth and how to preserve it and, the damage that fakes and manipulated media could create. And of course, this is also present in China, but I think that, the name we give to things also, in a way, leads us to, or at least leads popular debate to discuss what they mean rather than the way in which they're used practically. And that's it. So I think for me, deepfakes, I mean, they're obviously a very interesting subject, but it helped for me to find a broader category. So for me, that would be synthetic media as an object. I think deepfakes are one kind of synthetic media, which is quite popular today. And as a practice, it would be media manipulation. So manipulating,
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. And I had come across just the very sort of more famous Tom Cruise yes. deepfake. And so as I was reading your paper, I was sort of relating in part to the kind of awe that these things generate and the impulse that we have to scrutinize those deepfakes as whether they're real or not. And so I'm really interested in this this kind of like the sense at the beginning of your piece of saying like, like trying to align certain features yeah. or trying to say like that can or can't be real based on these kind of comparisons and like a really close reading of these objects. And I thought, yeah, like, and I imagine most people listening will have a sense of deepfakes or can Google it and see that it is, it is very real. Like we're well past the point of being able to tell like that Tom Cruise one, although he has not aged, yeah. I guess the way Tom, like there are some yeah. signs, but like it's impossible to tell. We're already at that phase where the manipulation is sort of complete in that realm. What I found interesting in your piece though, was that particular video of Trump yeah. singing.
Yeah.
And to me, I clicked on that and I watched it and I was like, that was less compelling in some sense. Like it was, I don't know. But maybe it's like being outside of that context where I find that very hard to believe.
Oh, sure.
That, right. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about like, that link between these kind of manipulations and then the specific context. And in this sense, the Chinese context in which something like Trump singing, a song, would be read as possible, if I understood that right in the piece, like it did sort of pass that.
Yeah. So I think there is awe, because deepfakes and in general, the capability of generating synthetic faces is so advanced today. I mean, it's used in Hollywood movies where people go watch, movie in cinemas and you have actors who are dead or were not available for shooting that are basically deep faked into the movie. And, even if you go to the cinema at maximum resolution, it's really hard to kind of, spot the flaws. So it is definitely passing the human test in that sense. I think probably it would be easier to recognize them with machine vision. Like I know that there is constant improvements in research about detecting deep fakes. So it kind of goes hand in hand. The more they are developed, the more they are, the more the tools to detect them are developed as well. So I think we're going to get to a place where deepfakes will be unrecognizable for us, but we will have tools to prove, the truthfulness of a video. But the Trump example, I think that was the I don't remember the song, but I think it was Trump and Pompeo, a video of both of them singing the Chinese national anthem, probably. That was made. So this video was made by a Chinese user of one of these video sharing websites. And I think they used a very, not basic, but a very simple tool that was available online to basically animate static photos of Trump and Pompeo. So it's not a deep fake in the classic sense of swapping a face onto another. It's a synthetic media of basically taking a static image and then driving the motion of that image with a video. So I think this person took a video of themselves singing and then used his own face to animate their faces, and then put the song on top of it, and that was it. So my impression was that this was not made with a purpose of, you know, realism. Realism was not the purpose. I think the purpose was satire or making something funny, like Trump and Pompeo singing the Chinese national anthem. And I think the comments that I reported in the paper, some people were probably saying, oh, this can't be real because this, or they, oh my God, they're speaking Chinese so well. I think it's all part of the fun. So I think that's something that the term deepfake doesn't necessarily include, because it points you toward the, oh, is it real or is it fake? But sometimes, actually, I would say most of the deepfakes and this kind of manipulation that are produced for fun, or for the thrill, or for exploration of, you know, possibilities. And in this case, that person was definitely not trying to, you know, to tell people or prove to people that Trump could speak Chinese. It's pretty obvious that it was fake. But there was indeed some discussion of comments saying, oh, this cannot be fake for this or that reason. And I think this sort of discussion is part of the fun, is part of the, you know, commenting and interpreting a piece of media and also interpreting what deepfakes or face swaps in this case are meant to be like. So yeah, I was very interested in that example also because that example crossed over from Chinese platforms to Twitter. And I think I encountered it on Twitter, a few weeks after this Chinese user created it. And of course it was reposted by someone else without attribution. And it became sort of quite popular. A lot of people were retweeting it and nobody knew where it came from. So it was interesting to me to trace back the whole history of this piece of content. Also because the original creator actually had written, you know, do not reproduce or do not post it somewhere else. So there is a lot of interesting dynamics. You know, you make something that is already a manipulation of some other photo, but you don't want it to be disseminated, and then it's disseminated anyway, and it generates a lot of different discussions and different contexts. So.
Yeah, it's fair. Yeah, and I think what it highlights also is a little bit at this particular moment, the folks who are encountering that media object for the first time and wondering whether this can be real by virtue of not knowing deepfake technology, or even sort of that this would be something that could be in users' hands. So I think what I'm seeing is both the accessibility of the technology to make these deepfakes, and then on the other side, a lot of folks encountering this for the very first time and saying, well, it can only be real because we're not there. The technology should not be sophisticated enough for someone to be doing this, at least not outside of Hollywood or something. So I wonder if you can, you know, give us a sense a little bit of how accessible these technologies are. And it can be in the Chinese context as well, because I imagine this, you know, this happens in different sort of timeframes in different places, but in the Chinese context, like, is this something a lot of users are deploying, or is it something that, you know, people with very sort of advanced skill sets would be able to use?
Yes. I think that it changed very fast. So the research behind this article was done in 2020, I think from 2019 to 2020 and 2021. So, things were already changing during those years. When I started looking at deepfakes, there were some apps, so some mobile apps that would allow you to do very basic manipulation on short video clips, both in China and abroad. But from the beginning, so from when the deepfake user posted these products on Reddit, I think they actually put their model something that was available from free. I don't know if it was on GitHub. So technically, anyone could just, you know, install it and create deepfakes on their machine. But I would say that for years, this was, you know, very niche, not knowledge, because it was not that difficult, but the kind of processing power that you needed, you know, it requires some dedication to do them. And then with new models and, you know, some of these models were actually developed in collaboration with platforms like Snapchat or Chinese apps, Instagram and Snapchat, and probably TikTok. They today they all have filters that are basically using models for media synthesis or faces or expressions or whatever. So I think they have been popularized through apps today. And in terms of the more professional ones, there are software packages like Face Swap and Deepfake Lab. There's a number of them that you can download and use on your computer. And at that point, it just becomes a matter of processing power and the time you have. So for this article, I did part of my ethnographic approach to this was to take part in the community of creators in China and to learn to make a deepfake from tutorials and you know, interactions with others. And so I did use one of those pieces of software. I learned how to, you know, basically take a video myself and extract frames and train a model on my face and the face of a Chinese movie star, and then swap our faces. And I'm not, you know, I'm not a computer scientist. I can do some basic coding, but this didn't even require any coding. It was literally a piece of software like Photoshop with some buttons and sliders. And you do trial and error and you learn from people. And eventually it took me a long time because my computer was not that powerful. I think it took, you know, 500 hours to train it, you know, to a decent, for a decent outcome. But yeah. And so that's one thing. And also there is a number of tools that are now just uploaded online as software notebooks by computer scientists who want to put up demos. So I've noticed that a lot of users just use those tools that are available online. And then there are some kind of professional deepfake makers that offer their services online. So you can just pay a fee and basically say, hey, I want my face inside the Matrix movie, you know, and swap my face in for Neo and give me the movie. And then you pay, you know, an amount of money and they do it for you. And these ones, I actually attract some of them in the Chinese context because I was fascinated. I was really interested to see. A lot of people were telling me about this gray market of deepfakes in China. So yeah, that you could just, you know, buy software packages, or you could basically make them make movies, deepfake movies for you. So I was a bit curious about the prices, and they were very affordable. I mean, you could get a deepfake movie for a few, you know, $20, $30, $40 US dollars. So I think these are the main pathways of availability. I think in general, if you want to make a deepfake, you just need a little bit of time to learn how to do it, and it's quite available to the general public today.
Yeah, and you said in your experiment, which I love that you took that on as part of writing this piece. I think it adds you know, a lot of depth. And this idea that it would take 500 hours to train something that was, I guess your goal was, you know, you were satisfied once it was somewhat believable, while probably not perfect, right? And it's really interesting because 500 hours, I mean, that's a lot of time. And it's really interesting that you're saying, you know, it was based on sliders and not coding. And so I guess, you know, we're already seeing, you know, it's sort of an important note, because it's already, you know, that some of those values and some of those like presets, literal presets, are already sort of baked into the apparatus that you would use. And then it's about training it to specific sort of, I guess, pixel values and other things that would align eyes to eyes and corners of mouths, and, you know, like we see often in, like, you know, used to be in sci-fi movies where they would scan your face and there'd be all these points, but that's actually what you probably line up. And because there's a bit of movement and a little bit of variation in faces, then it's about aligning those things. So it's like both sophisticated and also sort of easy enough to illustrate. And I think what the example really shows on that sort of, because I'm interested in the, you know, the affective registers and the sort of like emotional reactions to this, is like, and one of the first things I noted when I read your article was that, you know, from play to threat. And I see it in every example. There's kind of like, yeah, you can swap your face out for, you know, to be Neo in the Matrix, or you can have your face swap to be, you know, to create celebrity porn or whatever. And it's like those things really, it's a fine line sort of, you know, it's the same technology. It's the same, I guess, time investments, energy investments, with really different sort of outcomes and really different set of ethics around that. And I think in your piece, you know, you do address some of those concerns at you know, in this context, and that there was, you know, it went quite quickly from this playful thing to the kind of thing that needed to be monitored, and you know, some policies had to be developed around this. So do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, not just the shift, but the implications of that shift?
Yeah, for sure. What I thought was quite fascinating there is that writing about this, let me, I don't remember if I wrote this into the article, because I cut a lot of things for work out, but there was an incident in China in the 2000s of this school kid who became quite famous. This was, you know, internet pre-social media times, basically. This school kid who became quite famous was a chubby kid, and someone took a photo of him, and he became a meme. He became one of the earliest memes in China, and at the time memes were photoshops, quite, you know, crude photoshops. And so this kid had a funny face, and a lot of people took his face and put it onto the bodies of, you know, cartoon characters, celebrities, whatever, and this kid became a overnight celebrity himself, one of the earliest internet celebrities, until people started putting his face on, again, you know, porn stars, or you know, more questionable, producing more questionable kinds of content. And then in interviews, he actually said, you know, this ruined my life. It was horrible. This was not good. And I don't think any kind of legal action was taken. But for sure, that really made me think about the same pattern that happens with very different tools, right? And in that case, it was just Photoshop. And it was just the intersection between internet culture and, you know, the idea that's just a regular person could become a celebrity, and then user generated content and no checks and balances on this kind of sharing. But the ethical implications are sort of the same, because yes, today you could use deepfakes to do the same thing. And then, you know, the harm would probably be exactly the same kind of harm, regardless of the, you know, how realistic it is. So that really, I guess, shaped my historical perspective on this. And in China, this was also interesting because I don't know if it today would probably be the same everywhere. But at that time, a couple of years ago, the popularization of deepfakes through apps created some panic about other systems like face recognition, payments, or security, you know, because people suddenly thought, okay, now I'm using my face to pay for things, to unlock my phone, to go to my bank and be identified, I go to the airport and they tell me where my flight is on my face. But now what happens when people can make deepfakes? So if someone makes a deepfake on my face, they can go to the airport and take my plane, right? So so that was quite, you know, it was something that was discussed, and it's something that I saw both private companies and the government have to respond to by saying, you know, companies said, no, don't worry, you know, our systems are more sophisticated. You cannot trick them with deepfakes. And the companies that were offering the deepfake services would say, okay, we will put watermarks, and we will clearly put something that says this is a deepfake and it cannot be used for this or that. And then the government, you know, stepped in and sort of try to regulate the whole field by addressing, you know, the root problem, which is, you know, the generation and the sharing of deepfakes before they become a problem, you know, more specific problems for personal image rights, for, you know, ethical, unethical use of images, or, you know, harassment and things like these. So I have not seen any specific case of, you know, harm done with a deepfake yet in China, but I'm sure there are. But I know that in Taiwan, there was a case of, I think, of an internet, again, a internet celebrity who was a victim of someone creating a deepfake porn with her face, and then there were legal ramifications there. So I think what's important to conclude, I think what's important is is the legal aspect. So it's creating mechanisms to protect people's image rights from misuse, both from, you know, private other individuals, but also from the companies who collect and process your face data, which should be, you know, quite private matter. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm thinking back to the example that the early example that you gave of the clip where they were singing, and how that started circulating very quickly without any sort of, you know, links to authorship or credit. And I was just thinking, sure, you could say, you know, that there should be some, you know, legal action towards those who create and or circulate, you know, deepfake porn and things like that. But it's also occurring to me that that would be very difficult to assign or, find the original sort of author of these things. And the damage is sort of done in the creation of those things. As soon as it sort of is, you know, released, then it's very hard. It's very hard to track. And I think the other sort of thing that we've seen is that well before deepfakes, these kinds of like attacks on women, the kind of like misogyny that is often sort of perpetuated and enhanced through technology, well before deepfakes, which is an even more compelling, has been hard, you know, whether it was Photoshop or whether it's just kind of like, you know, doxing and other things. Like, technology has already sort of, we have seen this, you know, exacerbated problems around racism, misogyny, et cetera. And so it's really interesting to me to think that the regulation will be at the level of sort of like locating and tracking, and then sort of like, you know, a kind of like fine or punishment for whoever sort of created this. And it feels very unrealistic to me. And I guess I'm just having a moment of realizing that like these things will become more popular, will be increasingly harder to tell from the real, in the same way that Tom Cruise one is in particular, and then how hard it will be to trace. So I'm trying to think, you know, anticipate a little bit of like, what will we do maybe collectively, societally, to coexist, I think, with deep fakes, right? And that's what I'm anticipating a little bit, is that for now it's sort of on that cusp. There are some tells and some deep fakes that make it more entertainment than threat. But I think it will be about imagining a kind of coexistence with these things. And I guess in some ways, though it's hard to imagine now, becoming comfortable with not knowing. I don't know if you have any, I know that's sort of like a more abstract philosophical question, but I guess that's what I'm anticipating when I read your piece, just, you know, that deepfakes are introducing these kinds of digital humans, these kind of like not interactive necessarily, but I think that's coming as well, but like a very sort of compelling, multidimensional, you know, kind of fake human into the world, and that we will interact with. And I know that we in fact interact with all sorts of AI and fakes already, but there's something about it being in our likeness, especially in video format, that I think, you know, asks something different of us that we're not, you know, fully equipped with emotionally at this stage. So I don't know if you have just like a sense, you know, without predicting, just like a sense of like the consequences of something like that.
Yes. I've read a number of legal scholarship on deepfakes, mostly from the US. And I was actually quite impressed by the, by how, you know, how up to date it was in terms of understanding the possible harm that it would result from, you know, from this kind of behavior. But I don't know how, you know, that's just scholarship, is not necessarily regulation yet, and it's not necessarily digital literacy that's, you know, developed in peoples and users. But I think, yeah, I think you're right. We will definitely coexist with them, but I think that also, yeah, literacy about the ethical and legal implications of these things will necessarily need to become more, you know, developed. And what I was thinking is that it would sort of be like the revenge porn, like the change of regulation and around revenge porn, which, you know, until a few years ago, it was, you know, it just happened. So there will be revenge porn of you posted online, and not much you could do. And I, at least for the things I followed in Italy, recently. There's, you know, there's new laws, and it's, you know, you have a way of asking it for it to be taken down, and, you know, for the people who did it to be persecuted, you know, of course, if you can find them. But I imagine that for deepfakes, for this use of deepfakes for, you know, targeted harassment of people or, you know, creating pornography, there will need to be regulations so that, you know, you have legal recourse for, you know, basically use of your face, your likeness, and, you know, and being harassed by creation of material that, you know, puts you in a, yeah, just misrepresents you or, you know, harms you directly. And I think that is, it needs to be disconnected from the debates around truth and fake, or, you know, you know, how to identify if it's real or not, because that's not the key point. It's also dangerous to use that as a decision making point, because there might be a video that you don't like that's made with your likeness, even with these new image generation tools, that could be, people could say, well, that's fake, so it's not really about you, right? But if you feel harmed by it, or if you don't like it, or you don't want your facial data to be used in that, you should have a way to take your data away, or you know, make that, you know, take that down from the internet. So I think the debate around truthfulness and fakery, it's a different one. It's more connected to the reliability of an information source. And I think with the Ukraine war, it was probably the first time that deepfakes, or at least Russian forces, tried to deploy deepfakes in a real conflict setting. I think they tried to make some deepfakes of Zelensky saying things like, oh, the war is over, Ukraine is surrendering, or whatever. That was in the early days. But, you know, there is the possibility that as these both video and audio manipulation tools become more sophisticated, that they will be used in this sort of situations. And that is where, you know, recognizing truth from manipulation is important. I think there are two separate, related but separate debates.
I think that's super important, that idea that, you know, to not maybe assign agency to a deep fake that is your likeness, and then to say, well, you are not really this thing that is in your likeness. And that's super, I mean, I'm really concerned, but also looking forward to seeing how that plays out, what kind of agency we assign to deep fakes. And then it also sort of brings in this idea that, like, these things, you know, if it's already being used in the context of the war in Ukraine, which I didn't know about, that's like a remarkable example. There's also a sense in which, like, it will become so common. So it'll always be a consideration to say, is this, you know, is this Zelensky, or is this a deepfake Zelensky? Like, I think we're going to start asking this. And there was a concept, I think, that you borrowed in your piece that I thought was very good, because, again, it's sort of like specific to the context that you were looking at. But it was like the cabbageification. I thought that was so fun and like very good. But it sort of speaks to this idea that it will become, I think that the point being made through that concept, and please correct me if I'm wrong or elaborate, but it's a sense that it will become sort of an everyday occurrence, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, how delightful as a concept.
Yeah, yeah. It literally means, yeah, it will become like a cabbage. So it will become like so mundane and cheap also. And everyone will, you know, you can just buy it at the market downstairs. Yeah. And I think it's also connected to this idea. This concept I found really useful, the shallow fakes. It was in a report, I think, by Joan Donovan. I don't remember all the authors, but yeah. And that was also interesting, because they developed this spectrum that goes from deep fakes to shallow fakes, and with a lot of things in the middle. And so I think that's important, because it makes you think about, why are we calling them deepfakes, right? Okay, because they made with deep learning, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're so deep, right? And there's the opposite pole is also fakes that are not necessarily made with deep learning. They could be made with much more mundane and, you know, everyday technologies, and they might be as effective. I mean, we've gone through a, you know, a decade of horror wrecked by fake news, and, you know, all kinds of debates around fake news. Of all kinds, And sometimes they're very, you know, low tech. And to make something that's believable doesn't necessarily take a deep learning model. And conversely, you can take a deep learning model and make something that's unbelievable and just, you know, maybe you just made it for fun. So I think that that's also something that helped me think through these things. Yeah.
Yeah, that's perfect. And it's sort of like, you know, we were sort of come full circle to the beginning of the conversation too, which I really like. It wraps it up very nicely.
Yeah, if you need any reference from what we talked about, I mean, many of them are in the paper, but I'm happy to send you, yeah, if you need.
Perfect. Okay, so we'll link those. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, really appreciate your time.
Yeah, my pleasure. I know my research group will love the podcast, so send it over when it's ready. I'll share, I mean, all of the episodes, so...